Okay, let me just ask you one question. You can turn to chapter 16. That's where we're going to be beginning. And most of our time will be in chapter 17 this morning, which is about Babylon. 17 and 18 are about Babylon. And by way of reminder, where we are, this is our little roadmap of Revelation. And you'll remember that there are four visions. There are many visions, but there are four visions in Revelation that begin with the phrase, "And I was in the spirits." And it introduces that little phrase. I've given you the four references there. These are in your back notes. I needn't turn to them now. But four times the phrase comes, "I was in the spirit," introducing vision one, which is Christ and the seven churches, and then this long vision two, which is the seven seals, trumpets, signs, and plagues. We're just finishing here. This is the most difficult section of Revelation here, and we're just finishing. And then vision three and vision four are a contrast between two cities, which really stand for two systems, Babylon and Jerusalem. And then we wrap it up in chapter 22. So that's our little roadmap where we've been traveling. But we're going to be getting into what Babylon is this morning, vision three. But let me just ask a question. What would you say globalization is? Just, you know, no right and wrong answer here. And probably nothing you will say will be wrong, but it might not be. It might just be a piece of it. What would you say globalization is? We talk about it all the time. Randy?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Nowadays, everything we do here impacts everything else.
Okay. Interconnectedness. And I was just, because I don't know a lot about American history, so I have to catch up fast. And I discovered the significance of the Union Pacific Railroad, that it really, you know, it really connected the nation. And I think that I read that it cost, you know, normally about $2,000 to cross the continent, and took between 6 and 9 months. And with the opening of the railroad, I think tickets were $150. And it took you 7 days, something like that. Now, what happened there that united, of course, this vast continent has happened globally. That's another part of it. Dell?
Communications
is a lot of it, which is, again, the astonishing thing that you can just go online and you can access websites all over the world. It just is phenomenal. Phenomenal. Another piece, Becky? Sorry? That's right. We just had the euro, which is, again, is tying things together. Okay, so we have a kind of multiculturalism that is, again, shrinking everything. Okay?
Standardization.
Standardization is another factor. Calendars are now standardized. They never used to be. You know, calendar in China was entirely different. Islamic calendar was entirely different. Now they're standardized. Chet?
Authority and allegiance.
Okay.
Okay. In Europe, this is certainly.
Okay, so a kind of internationalism is arriving on the scene. These are all components of globalization. But if you want just a simple definition of what globalization is, and all these are the tentacles of it, globalization is the abolition of trade tariffs. That's the technical definition of globalization. Because, of course, there have always been trade tariffs. And so I can remember when I was visiting Trinity many, many years ago, I think I remember having my 40th birthday party with Doc and Nancy. I also had my 21st birthday party with Pastor and Nancy. But I remember on that occasion, I made the great mistake of buying a computer here Okay, and did they give me a hard time when I got to Heathrow? A really hard time. They weren't convinced of its price. They weren't convinced of... we've lived with that. There have been trade tariffs. You remove the trade tariffs, and suddenly you've got a global market. And of course, into that comes everything else that you've been speaking about. Now, what we're going to find in chapter 17, when we get to Babylon, is we're going to get a picture of globalization, which was not true even 50 years ago. It was not true 25 years ago. But now all the elements are to make what we see of Babylon in Revelation 17 and 18 are all present now. Okay, they were not perhaps even 10 years ago, but they're all present now. And we'll see that Babylon is a system, and it is primarily, not only, it's a trading system. Now, of course, in with the trading system comes government, comes pluralization, comes communication, comes internationalism, etc. And so why that's so interesting is that we're now going to study a chapter of scripture that never before in history did it quite fit. But all the component pieces are now there as we've moved into what we're calling globalization, which is a many-faceted thing. But we're just going to finish chapter 16 before we get there. And chapter 16, and we reached, I think, the first five plagues last time of chapter 16. And this, I think, is a... and if you don't have it, you can pick it up when you leave. This is our, I think it's a two or three page handout on the seven plagues in chapter 16. And you remember, we've gone through seven seals, we've gone through seven trumpets, we've gone through seven signs, and we've gone through seven, we've gone through one, two, three, four, five plagues, and now we've just got two to go. And then we're through this section. And so this is your sheet, and I just want to say two things before we begin. The first is the similarity between the seven trumpets and the seven plagues. And I've given you the details there, but it's very, very distinct if you trace it out. If you look at the seven trumpets and the seven plagues, number one is a judgment on the land. Number two, in both, judgment on the sea. Number three, in both, inland waterways. Number four, in both, the sun. Something's happening to the sun. Number five, in both, the demonic and the beast. And number six, in both, the Euphrates. We'll come again to what that means. And then number seven in both, what I believe is consummation. Because you'll remember that at the end of each one, we get what I believe is a sign of the end, okay? Which is thunder, earthquake, lightning, voices, which is an Old Testament theophany for the arrival of God, like when God arrived on Mount Sinai. And so you remember that we've not been seeing these as one after the other, linear and consecutive, but we've been seeing them a little bit like the four Gospels, that they're all a perspective on the same period of time, approaching it from different perspectives, and that's how we've been viewing the material. And so just two things I want to say before we go to the plague number six, is the parallel between the seven trumpets and the parallel with the plagues of Egypt. And so we're going to have grievous sores, okay, that's verse 2, sea becoming like blood, verse 3, rivers polluted, verse 4, and these, of course, I'm giving you the parallels in Exodus, the sun is affected, verse 8, darkness, verse 10, frogs, which in this case are demonic spirits, verse 13, and then hail. And you'll remember with the plagues of Egypt that every plague, you remember, every plague was an attack on what? That's right, on the gods of Egypt. And so they worshipped the Nile, and so it's turned into a foul, stinking river. They were sun worshippers, and so the sun is darkened. And in the book of Revelation, it actually is not a blessing, it's a curse, because the intensity, you remember, of the sun is increased, and men are burnt. But let's pick up now verse 12 of Revelation 16. Verse 12, and this is plague number 6. Okay, so the sixth angel poured his bowl, and you remember the best translation is his chalice, on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. And I saw issuing from the mouth of the dragon, and from the mouth of the beast, the Antichrist, the dragon being Satan, the beast being the Antichrist, and from the mouth of the false prophet. And so we've got this kind of demonic counterfeit of the Trinity, okay? Foul spirits like frogs. And they are demonic spirits performing signs who go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for the battle on the great day of God the Almighty. And so what we've got here, and we've had a little bit of this before, okay, is we've got the Euphrates mentioned, just as it was in the trumpets. And of course, the Euphrates was a great physical barrier, okay? We knew what was up to the Euphrates, but we really didn't know what was beyond the Euphrates. And so if you have a little map of the Middle East, and you've got Galilee, and you've got the Dead Sea, and then over here you've got the Tigris and the Euphrates. And we kind of knew, okay, Assyria, Babylon, etc., Elam, but beyond the Euphrates was kind of, reminds you of the medieval maps, you remember, before we discovered the New World, that they would just have, you know, at the end of the map, you remember, they would say, beyond this point, there be dragons, okay? That's what they used to write on the medieval maps, because you didn't know what was beyond there. And that was what the Euphrates was like. Beyond the Euphrates is kind of barbarism. It's kind of uncharted territory. The interesting thing is, of course, the Euphrates was the limit of the empire in the days of Solomon, okay, and in the days of the Roman Empire, in the days of John. And beyond it lay these kings from the east, a little bit like the Vandals in Europe coming from the north, and the Goths and the Visigoths who brought destruction. And unclean spirits like frogs, okay, they go forth unto the kings of the whole world. And it's interesting that it says unto the kings. It doesn't mean to say that they don't go out to deceive you and I, but obviously there's going to be, just as was mentioned when we were talking about globalization, there's going to be a harnessing of international power, okay? And so the primary attack, yes, it will come on the ordinary person, okay, but there will be an ensnaring of government and political leadership. And we'll see that as we go on in just a minute. So it's interesting that they go forth unto the kings of the earth. You would just think they would say, unto all mankind, but no, the rulers, those in government, those with leverage. That's plague 6. And then we get a little parenthesis in verse 15. And you remember that I've said before, okay, that with the seals, the trumpets, the signs, and the plagues, that each one has a parenthesis. Okay, each one has a little parenthesis. We had a parenthesis here, one here, 144,000, one here, which was the throne, and now we've got just one here, which is just one little verse of encouragement. And it simply says, verse 15, the Lord kind of breaks in, and he says, lo, I'm coming like a thief. Blessed is he who's awake. So there are going to be people in the midst of this chaos who are going to be awake. They're going to be awake. Blessed is he who is awake, keeping his garments, that he may not go naked and be exposed. And there are actually seven, you see this little, blessed is he. There are seven beatitudes in the book of Revelation. There are lots of sevens in the book of Revelation, but there are seven beatitudes, and you can jot down the references if you don't have time to do anything else. And now we could say that there are eight, because the first one is blessed is he who reads, and we could say the second one is blessed is he who hears. Okay, so there are seven or there are eight. How many beatitudes did Jesus give in the Sermon on the Mount? Eight, that's right, eight. And so possibly we've got a matching set in the book of Revelation. But they're very different, they're complementary, but they are very different. And perhaps they are little indicators of what we've got to particularly hold on to as we move. It doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't be pure in heart, that we shouldn't be peacemakers, of course not. But perhaps these are added almost in, you know, as I always say that beatitudes are the beautiful attitudes, that we need to have. And perhaps it's particularly important that we're not afraid to die, because now blessed are they who die in the Lord. We're not afraid of death, even though it's all around us. We treasure the word. Blessed is he who reads, and blessed is he, because we need to know in the midst of this globalization, okay, this mass of information, this information age. I don't know about you, but I am all the time on total overload with information. I mean, I thought email was such a blessing. But I tell you, I'm afraid to open it now. Not of yours, Ed. Yours are wonderful, okay? So, you know what I mean? Because it's just, is anybody in this room caught up with their reading? Okay? I think they said that Benjamin Franklin was the last living man to read everything that had been published in the English language. Okay? Now it would be, I'm reading a Swiss theologian at the moment, probably one of the five greatest theologians in the 20th century, and they say that he probably wrote more than the average man can read today. And so we just live, you know, where, you know, we're, I always feel I'm behind with my reading, and I think you, and we have to be very discerning what we read, because I think a ploy of the enemy could be that we read a whole bunch of stuff that we don't need to read. We're listening to a whole bunch of messages that we don't need to listen. So perhaps these beatitudes are particularly appropriate for us as we move into the end of the age. And so we get this little parenthesis peeking its way in here, which is the voice of the Lord saying that he's coming like a thief, and but there will be those who will be awake. And then we get verse 16, which is Armageddon. And you'll remember that last week we dealt, not last week, but the last time we met, we dealt with Armageddon. And so I'm not going to spend much time on it, but I do want to just say a few things as we go past very, very quickly. Let's read verse 16. And they assembled them. Okay, these are these invading demonic hordes. The place which is called in Hebrew Har Megiddo. Now, some of you have seen it, and Armageddon is only used once in the Bible. But Megiddo, okay, is used many times in the Old Testament. And I said last time that it was the famous battleground both for Israel and for the surrounding nations. In other words, if you controlled the plain of Jezreel, which was only about 20 miles by about 7, you controlled the major marching route of armies between Africa, Asia, and Europe, and the major trade routes. We're back to trade again. If you controlled, okay, the valley of Jezreel, where was the mount of Megiddo? And you remember last time, and that's why I'll only do it quickly, this, if you've been to the Holy Land, you know that there's this spine of mountains running up through Israel. And so how it works, those of you who have been there, is if you fly into Tel Aviv and you go to Jerusalem, you have to go up. Or if you're down in the Jordan, you have to go up because there's this spine of mountains. But there's a break. There's a break in the spine, and it comes right here. And this is the Valley of Jezreel. And these were the killing fields in the ancient world, not just for Israel. The Egyptians fought there. The Babylonians fought there. The Assyrians fought there. Saul died there. This is where Deborah had her great battle. You can read of one of the pharaohs who had a major battle there in 1500 BC. And so this was one of the great kind of killing fields of the ancient world. And if you've been there, and in fact, when I was in Nazareth, you can look down from Nazareth right over. I don't know if you can just dim the light just for a minute, Jeff. We can see that, I think, pretty well. Okay, this is the mount here. It's the mount here. It's not very high. Okay, the mount. But the importance of the mount is simply because it's overlooking the valley, and you can see mountains in the background here. But this is just like it is as flat as flat. It's very cultivated now. It looks quite beautiful. But this was the ancient killing grounds where armies coming from east, west, north, and south would clash on this battleground. But what we said, and lights can go up, please, and what we said, the interesting thing, was that Israel's, the last Davidic king, okay, in Israel, to be an independent ruler from the house of David was Josiah. Now, his sons and his grandsons, so his grandson was the last, okay, they were puppet rulers because now Babylon had invaded. And now Israel was really under the thumb of Babylon. But the last independent ruler from the house of David was Josiah. And where did he die? In battle where? That's right, at Armageddon, okay, in the valley of Jezreel. That's where he died, okay? So what's it saying? It's going to be saying, of course, that the house of David is going to be reestablished by the son of David, and where everything was lost, it's going to be reestablished. And even more than that, the Prince of Peace is going to come, okay, to the killing fields, because I believe that more than a physical location is representative of all the killing fields, whether it's Cambodia, whether it's Sudan, whether it's Somalia, okay, it represents that. Where so much blood has been shed, and where the house of David, okay, was lost, the son of David will return and defeat his enemies. And so John is picking up on this wonderful Old Testament material with Armageddon. And then just plague number 7, and then we'll have some questions. We'll move on to plague number 7. Verse 17, okay, plague 7, and then finally, after all these weeks, we would have made it, okay, through all the sevens. And so and through the most difficult part of Revelation. Okay, so chapter 16 and verse 17. And the seventh angel poured out his chalice into the air. Notice, into the air. And a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne saying, "It is finished." That ring a bell? That's right, it rings a bell, you see. We had D-Day, okay, when Jesus cried, "It is finished." Okay, now we've got V-Day, okay, and all the victory of the cross now is being fulfilled in time and space. And there were flashes of lightning, voices, peals of thunder, and a great earthquake, and we've seen that at the ends of the sevens. And verse 19, the great city, okay, the great city. Now, Babylon is a system, okay? Just like Jerusalem, okay, the real Jerusalem, when you are born again, it says you've come to Mount Zion. Okay, this is a, you see, we've got two societies. One which began in Genesis 11. What began in Genesis 11? Somebody's whispering it. Babylon, that's right. They sought, you remember, by human effort to get up into the heavens. Genesis 11. And so Genesis 12, what begins in Genesis 12? Sorry? Okay, but give me a name. Abraham, that's right. And it says Abraham went out looking for a city whose builder and maker was God. That's right. And he was looking for a society that was not based on human efforts. And that's why when we get into Revelation, it will say that Jerusalem comes down from heaven, because every other society or city comes up from the ground. Once there was nothing here, okay, in Omaha, but brick by brick it came up from the ground. Once there was nothing in Chicago, brick by brick it came up from the ground. But Abraham goes out looking for something else, a city whose builder and maker, not like Babylon, human effort, and we're going to get control, okay? We're going to get real governments, okay, by human effort. No, he's going in the other direction, and counter to Babylon is this city whose builder and maker is God. And so we've got more than a city here, we've got a system, and you were describing that system when we began this morning. And so it's split into three parts, and when that happens, the cities of the nations fall, because of course Babylon is the glue that's holding them together. And God remembered great Babylon to make her drain the cup of the fury of his wrath. And every island fled away, and no mountains were to be found. And great hailstones, as heavy as 100 weight, dropped on men from heaven. Till men, isn't this sad? Okay? When there was great hail in Egypt, even Pharaoh repented, at least briefly. Okay? And he said, okay, let them go. Now he changed his mind. But now, and men cursed God for the plague of hail, for so fearful was that plague. Just a couple of things. It's not a complicated passage. I want you to note that it says in verse 1, that this plague is poured out into the air, because Babylon primarily is something supernatural. Something supernatural. It is a supernatural system, and that's why it has to be dealt with supernaturally. And that's why it's poured out into the air, which of course is the abode of principalities and powers. There's a great voice crying, "It is done." Okay, we are into consummation. And then we have the lightning, the voices, the thunder, and a great earthquake. And this is the theophany that's come again and again, indicating the arrival of the Lord. And what I've been saying, okay, as we've been moving through, looking at these as being not so much linear and sequential, okay, but rather being parallel and coterminous, is because at the end of each one, we have this description of the arrival of the Lord. Well, actually, here we have the throne, slightly different configuration, but it comes again and again. And I did give you early on the reasons why these might be parallel rather than coterminous. And you needn't hunt for that now, because I don't really want to go into it in any depth. But all I'm really pointing out here, I think we gave this out probably when we got into this section, that this structure would parallel Daniel, which goes through the same period four times in the book of Daniel. Okay, parallels the Gospels, where we go through four times. But the interesting thing and the important thing is that it's not simply going through, but there's greater intensification as we move on. And so the seals, they're just kind of spread out over the whole lot. But the plagues, there's intensification. Yes, they cover the tribulation period, but with kind of greater focus and intensity on the end. And another reason why I think that they are coterminous is simply Matthew 24. Okay, what's Matthew 24? Somebody tell me. It's our Lord's description of the end of the age. And Matthew 24 exactly parallels, the seals. Now, if they weren't coterminous, and parallel, our Lord would have only given us 25% of the material on the end of the age. And that's why I believe that they are overlapping. But all I'm really pointing out, got the wrong one on, I'm losing myself in plastic here, all I really was going to say, where'd it gone? Why don't you sing a hymn or something while I... it doesn't really... I was just giving you the references where it says many times that there was an earthquake, as we come to the end of the seals, an earthquake, fire, voices, lightning, etc., indicating a theophany of the coming of the Lord, with the exception here of where we get the throne. And there's a parenthesis in each one as well, indicating this parallelism. Okay, let me just say a few things about Plague 7, then we'll have some questions. I was sitting on what I was looking for. That's why I couldn't find it. There it is. Yes, I also lose my glasses frequently, and you know where you discover them, don't you, Jim? Right on your nose. So it's just part of getting old. I think it might have been Pastor who once said that the advantage of getting old is that you can buy your own birthday presents and still be surprised when you open them. So there's a few of those Scottish jokes that I still remember. So those of you who may not know, this just a little interlude here, is that I worked with Pastor and Nancy when I was 20 years old, for a year. So I've known them for, got to do a quick calculation here, 35 years. And I kid you not that in all of my ministry, which was not spent in Trinity, been more recently, when I would be in a situation where I would be bewildered to know what to do pastorally, I would always say to myself, what would Doc do? I have to excuse me calling him Doc, but he's kind of a dad, you see. I would always pause over all those and kind of think, what would Doc do? And those, what Doc sowed into my life and Nancy, they formed my ministry. So now I tease them, you see. That's my privilege of being able to tease them. So, any questions? Well, I think we kind of Did we hit it all? Not quite. No. Okay, let's just say a couple of things here, and then you may have some questions before we move into the next chapter. This is not complicated. I've mentioned there's this cry, it is done. There's this theophany. The great city is split into three parts. Perhaps it's this disintegration of this demonic trinity, okay, that is the glue holding things together. Because a house divided against itself cannot stand. And don't think that the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet are a happy band of brothers, because evil is always disintegrating. And Babylon, who made the nations drink the wine of her fornication, is now given the wine cup of the fury of his wrath. And every island fled away, and no mountains were to be found. So there's no remote island or mountain fortress that remains as a refuge from the wrath of God. Interesting with them searching the caves in Tora Bora, that when evil is exposed, men hide in the caves of the mountains. That's why they say they'll flee away. It's simply saying there'll be no refuge in the mountains or in the remote islands. And then always in the Gospels, rain and sunshine is a blessing from God. He sends his rain on the just and on the unjust. Okay, now what comes down is frozen, it's hail, it's destructive. And it says in Isaiah that the hail will sweep away the refuge of lies. And it's almost that hail of this size is almost scouring the earth of this pollution of evil that's been raging during the tribulation period. And I mentioned that under such hail, even Pharaoh showed signs of repentance, be they temporary, but now men curse God for the plague of hail. Okay, so any questions before we move on? Okay, we'll come to that, I think, a little more in the next chapter, okay? But what happens when Babylon disintegrates, it says the cities of the world begin to disintegrate. And so this system that's been put in place begins to break up. And I think it's actually because what you'll find in the next chapter is that the beast, you remember, devours the harlot. The harlot is Babylon. And the beast, now the beast has been happily carrying the harlot's been riding on the beast. But I think it's this thing of evil, okay, is self-disintegrating, okay? And as I say, evil people are never for very long, okay, a happy band of brothers, okay? It always is disintegrating. And it may just parallel the three parts, you know, this demonic, you know, the dragon, the beast, the false prophet, we don't know, okay? But there's more coming. In 17 on this. Well, it's just the technical definition of globalization. If you looked it up, you know, what technically is globalization? It's the abolition of trade tariffs globally, which is a totally new thing, which of course means it's just like Europe now. You know, for, you know, since the Roman Empire, okay, Europe has of course been divided into, I think it's, is it 41 nations in Europe, Jim? I think it's 41 or 42. You know, now suddenly, you see what I mean? They're abolishing all trade tariffs. You know, and suddenly you don't need a passport. Do you see what I mean? There's interchange. Now, when that happens, everything else that you were speaking about can also happen. You know, so, you know, whether it's government, you know, and that's what's happening in Europe. The European Union began as the European Economic. Okay, it was only for trade at the beginning, but the originators of the European Economic Union, they were looking for eventual political union. Whether they'll achieve it, we don't know. But once you know you drop your Deutschmark and you drop your franc, you know that is the essence of globalization. Exactly, exactly. And it says in Babylon, was found the blood of all those who were slain on the earth in Babylon. So this is the system, okay, that destroys human life. And as you say, and so it may have, and we'll see this in the next chapter, it may have a hub, you know, that has a physical location, okay, because most power systems need that, but it is truly global. And we'll see that in chapter 17 and 18. Yes, Randy. Okay, Randy's question is this gathering on the plain of Jezreel, is it literal or metaphorical? And to give an honest answer, commentators are divided both ways here. Some would see it as, you know, this is the ancient killing fields, and what it's saying is that there the Prince of Peace will reign. Others are saying that, no, there will be a physical gathering in the plain of Jezreel, you know, with, you know, the massing of forces, you know, against Israel. And so you take it both ways. And what we're trying to do in this class is, rather than, you know, go for one, just one opinion, is we're trying to say, what does it say theologically? What it says theologically is, of course, where the house of David was lost, the Son of David will return. The Prince of Peace will put his feet on the killing fields of this world. And so then you can take your choice whether that is metaphorical. Definitive declarations, because that's not where we're going kind of in the class, but trying to help you understand the text, and then you can do further reading, tracking these things down. Right, right. Well, that's a great, why can't it be both? And I think that often in the book of Revelation, it's both. Often it's both. And I think that that's very well said. Yeah. Okay. The question was, you know, why can't it be both, that Armageddon is representing all the killing fields, but there is still a specific event on that territory? You see what I mean? It's both. Yeah, yeah. So, and I think that it is, as we saw in the book of Daniel, it's often both. And I think you're often getting that. Okay. The question is globalization good or evil? It's a little bit like saying, you know, is the internet good or evil? And again, I can remember a doc always quoting to me Tozer, who said we should postpone the inevitable. You remember that, Doc, so well. There is an inevitability, do you see what I mean, about the coming together. Now, we can use it for great advantage for the gospel. Like now, we can translate the Bible so much faster using computers. We can communicate with our missionaries instantly this afternoon. There is a kind of an inevitability about it. But let me say this, that I'm not so sure that if I was in Britain now, that I would vote for the euro. Do you see the point? Because perhaps we can postpone the inevitable. Do you see what I mean? And perhaps at times, you know, without being reactionary, and we say Luddites in England. The Luddites were people who kind of smashed the printing presses and whatever because they felt, you know, it was going to bring in. And we can't kind of, you know, go home and, you know, smash our computers and whatever. But perhaps we can, you know, make stands at certain points because we see that the disadvantage would outweigh the possible advantage. And so, you know, now when they're talking about, I don't know, Jim, you know, all your records being condensed, you know, onto one card, you know, or whatever, medical records, financial records. You can see the great advantage of that, okay? But perhaps we should draw the line because it would be hugely convenient. I'm in an accident and somebody just has to pull out a card and they can swipe it and get all my medical records. But perhaps the disadvantage of that being abused by the abuse of power. And so do you see what I mean? So it's a we can't stop some of the things, but perhaps we can draw some lines. Jenny's saying, why do people make such a big deal about Armageddon when there's only one verse in the Bible? It's interesting, isn't it? Interesting. Well, in a sense, it is the last battle, you see. It's the last battle. But actually, Armageddon isn't a battle. They gather, and the Lord comes. Gather, and the Lord comes. So in a sense, it's only the battle in as much as, you know, overwhelmingly, God intervenes. And so it is, in that sense, the last battle. And that's why John, picking up the Valley of Jezreel, you know, where Saul died, Deborah fought, Josiah died, the Pharaohs fought, the Babylonians fought, the Assyrians fought, is so meaningful. To that point, the Son of David, the Prince of Peace, will come. Yes. The question was, is Bin Laden's agenda global? And of course it is global, completely. It's global. And it's globalization through Islam is Bin Laden's agenda. Yes, that's right. And of course, Bin Laden, being a Saudi, the money has come from oil. All of Saudi is built on oil. But as Del was intimating, their reserves will run out. What is it, in 25 years' time or something? They're saying that the Saudi fields will basically be dry. And so again, he is using that leverage, you know, for his agenda. Very, very definitely so. One quick one, then we'll move on. Okay, that's a good question. Because the question was, why did he attack a symbol of globalization if his agenda is globalization? This is very important to understand. One of the things that the Muslims fear is a kind of cultural hegemony coming from the West. In other words, they see that we want to envelop the Islamic world with secular values. And of course, that is Babylon. That is Babylon. And so, in a sense, that now he will equate that with America, which is not a true equation. But what they feel, because the Islamic world for many, many centuries was the center of culture, it was a center of learning, mathematics, science, philosophy, while the West was in barbarism. Okay, now they feel that the scales have been turned, and now there's this cultural flow from the West, which they see as ungodly, which it is. And so what he's trying to do is bring down a kind of cultural dominance to replace it with something else. And of course, we know that much of what does flow from the World Trade Center is Babylon. Okay, it's not what this nation was founded on. Okay, and we might say there are many good things in the Trade Center, that is true, but what is happening in Revelation is that through demonic principality, and there's nothing wrong with trade, nothing wrong with industry and business, but it can be manipulated, and that's what we see in Revelation. Somebody mentioned this in the sense of suddenly, without delay. When the time comes, it's not a gradually unfolding event. Somebody said we're dealing with both sacred time and secular time. One day with the Lord is as 1,000 years. We do live in the last days now. It will come about in the last days that I'll pour out my spirit on all flesh. Okay, we weren't always in the end days, but we have always been in the last days. They're last. We had the days of Noah. We had the days of Abraham. We had the days of David. Okay, now we live in the day of the Lord, okay? And there's not going to be anything after that. Okay, so when the Muslims come along and say, no, now we live in another day. No, we're in the last day. It's not the day of our Lord Jesus Christ. It's not going to be superseded by any other day. It's the last epoch, the last day in that sense. And then there are some related phrases. And the end of all things is near, will come. And somebody said this, if the Omega is in our midst, therefore the end is present with us now and can break into this age wherever, whenever he chooses. And I put that little phrase, we now travel around the rim of eternity. And if you would, if you want to model it, if you would see God beginning with Abraham, working his way through the old covenant, is consummated in the cross, the resurrection, and now we're kind of, everything has been done to bring in the end, and we're almost like traveling now round the rim of eternity, and eternity can break into time whenever the Omega chooses to. Now we know that's set within a context of the fulfillment of his word. Doc? Well, I think personally that that is the greatest sign of the end of the age. I think it is a greater sign than even Israel coming back in 1948, because there's never been a period in history where there is a church in every nation. It's not a church in every people group yet, but we do live, you know, there's never been a time, you know, where today, all around the planet, there will be people worshiping in the name of Jesus. You go back 25 years, and that was not true. I mean, I can remember, you know, when I would teach on missions, and I'm sure you yourself, you'd have to mention nations where there was no church. That was not long ago. Now you can't do that. There are no nations where there is no church. There are people groups within those nations where there is no church. You know, but as far as this gospel of the kingdom will be preached as a witness to all nations, because I believe that when the Lord comes, no one's going to look up and say, who's this? Do you see what I mean? I think they're all going to know who it is. And I can remember sitting in the fellowship hall when you used to run the... you used to dress up as pilgrims, you remember? That was at Thanksgiving. That's right. And we used to have the international... And I can remember sitting at a table with some Chinese students and them asking me, who's this Jesus? I've never heard this name, you know. Well, the Lord is not going to come with a whole bunch of people saying, who are you? Who are you? No, I think they're going to know. They're going to know who he is together. Gone a little bit late. I apologize for that. But next week we will be in 17 and 18.